It is Friday, April the 20th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the looming U.S.-North Korean summit.
If you look at what success could mean for a summit, you're going to probably look for some broad announcements, but also something that is specific, that would be tangible evidence that maybe some success has been made by both sides.
Former New York City mayor joining the Trump legal team.
The president is going on the offensive. Rudy Giuliani isn't exactly low-key in the first place, and if you bring him on, it's because he's going to come out swinging for the base.
Valeria's on the upswing, learning about fake news, plus Time's 100 most influential people. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump said he will have a full agenda in proposed talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in the coming weeks. Following a second day of meetings this week with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Mr. Trump said he hopes for a successful outcome to such a meeting.
Hopefully that meeting will be a great success, and we're looking forward to it. It would be a tremendous thing for North Korea and a tremendous thing for the world. So we will be doing everything possible to make it a worldwide success, not just for the United States or South Korea or North Korea or Japan, but for the entire world.
Mr. Trump said the trip to North Korea by the director of U.S. Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, formed a good relationship with Mr. Kim. He also said denuclearization is a complete an irreversible way that would lead to a bright path for North Korea. However, he said he also is prepared to talk away from such a meeting, walk away, that is, should its success remain elusive. Mr. Trump also expressed concern at the trade imbalance with Japan and the need to remove trade barriers.
The United States is committed to free, fair, and reciprocal, very important word, trade. And we're committed to pursuing a bilateral trading relationship that benefits both of our great countries.
Jeffrey Horning said that Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, in political difficulty at home and facing now a leadership election later this year, needed to come away with something from his talks with President Trump, such as progress on the abduction issue or a moratorium on North Korean missile testing. Mr. Abe said U.S. exports to Japan are on the rise and Japan investment in the U.S. has increased. As for the Trump-Kim meeting, the RAND Corporation's Jeffrey Hornig tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the Pompeo visit to North Korea appears to confirm a Trump-Kemp meeting that would actually take place. But does he detect a change in North Korean behavior? Hornig is a bit skeptical.
The one thing that people need to keep in mind always is that what denuclearization means differs. So the U.S. and even Japan tend to look at denuclearization as complete, verifiable denuclearization, whereas North Korea looks at denuclearization from the standpoint of all nukes gone from the peninsula. This includes the U.S. nuclear umbrella. And so I think when you have negotiators sit down and when you do have the summit actually occur, they might come to the realization that their definitions of denuclearization differ.
President also indicated that negotiations are underway for the release of three Americans held as prisoners in North Korea. This is something that really has been under the radar and hasn't been talked much about.
If you look at what success could mean for a summit, you're going to probably look for some broad announcements, but also something that is specific, that would be tangible evidence that maybe some success has been made by both sides. And so something like the release of prisoners would be that low-hanging, tangible evidence that maybe the North Korean regime wants to show to the U.S. that's serious about talking.
And an issue that's very close to Mr. Abe, Japanese abducted by North Koreans. Mr. Trump said that's on the table as well.
Obviously, from the Japanese standpoint, they have three priorities for Mr. Trump. They're the same with the U.S. in terms of denuclearization and the ballistic missile program, basically scaling that down or abolishing that. But the third is Mr. Abe has made really a career out of trying to pursue the abductees that North Koreans have taken from Japan since the 70s and 80s. And he came here with a goal of making sure that Trump knew about this and that puts it on the agenda But I think there's still some skittishness within Tokyo about whether or not, if it comes down to a hard negotiation with denuclearization versus abductees, there's still skittishness on whether the U.S. would fulfill that.
The president brought up the issue of trade deficits with Japan. How big a deal is trade in Japan? Can this be resolved?
Trade is a big deal, but it's a big deal in the sense that Mr. Abe has worked for free trade, and he's really put a lot of investment into the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the multilateral trade agreement. Mr. Abe knows very well the U.S. complaints about the trade deficit, and he also knows very well that Mr. Trump would like a bilateral free trade agreement with Japan. They have not really shown any intention to work towards a bilateral free trade agreement, given how much energy Japan has put into the TPP.
That is RAND Corporation's Jeffrey Harning speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Says VOA's International Edition. Former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, an outspoken supporter of President Trump since the early days of his campaign, is joining the team of lawyers representing the president in a special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Mueller is trying to find out if there is any collusion between the Kremlin and the Trump presidential campaign and whether President Trump tried to obstruct the investigation. VOA's Lori London sought some perspective on the Giuliani joining the Trump legal team from Jack Rice. He is a former CIA officer, trial advocacy educator, and trial lawyer.
Well, I think what it really shows first is that the president is going on the offensive. Rudy Giuliani isn't exactly low-key in the first place, and if you bring him on, it's because he's going to come out swinging for the base.
So he's going to come out swinging. My understanding is that Giuliani wants to come in and look at a way to negotiate an end to the Mueller probe in a matter of weeks. Is that possible for an attorney to come in and do?
Yeah, when I heard that he wanted to negotiate a resolution to this and he wanted to end the probe, I actually started laughing because that's not how it works. You may come in and say, I want this to end. Well, guess what? I want to be a cowboy. That doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen either. So the idea that he's going to come in and dictate terms isn't going to happen. It simply is not.
What would he do to attempt to do that, and what would the response be from Mueller?
Well, the real reason is there's no necessary end date for Mueller. He doesn't have to end this by a certain date, and the investigation goes where the investigation goes. We know that he's indicted more than 19 people at this point. He has multiple pleas that have taken place, and the investigation continues. So the idea that this has to end this week, next week, or next month, the real question is, does the president have the capability, the power to leverage or force him to resolve the case? And the answer is he does not. And that's part of the negotiation process for Mueller. He doesn't have to do anything. He can continue to chug away and grind away at this because the angle isn't just at Trump. The angle is at a whole series of people, including some Russians, and that's continuing, including people like Cohen, as an example. All of those issues will continue to bear fruit. And so he can sit back and watch those and then drive where the evidence takes him.
But do you think it's possible that Giuliani, given who he is and the things he said in the past, could try to ultimately be on a somewhat of a, say, smear campaign against Mueller, come out with a sharp change public opinion about who Robert Mueller is and the credibility of the investigation?
I think very clearly that Giuliani is being brought on to go on the offensive. The purpose is he's going to go on all of the national shows. He's going to go on Fox. He's going to rev up the base. This is about undercutting Mueller. This is about undercutting the investigation, trying to drive it to end. But what's very clear here is that Bob Mueller is a very experienced investigator. He has some of the best. They have very real results that they're showing. The investigation will continue. And so the question will be, can Giuliani sway public opinion enough that this could influence the investigation? At this point, I would say no.
Okay. And last question, the Hillary Clinton emails. In the heat of the 2016 presidential campaign, Rudy Giuliani seemed like he had information about WikiLeaks about to release information. It seemed like he was sort of injecting himself into that whole situation and has injected himself into it enough to where he might have known things that were going to happen. I don't know if you'd call that a conflict or would he be...
I think based upon his own behavior during the election cycle, it tells me that he may be a person of interest himself. His claims of having knowledge about WikiLeaks and some of the other information that was going on would tell me that he seems to know things that publicly other people didn't know. I would want to know why, and I think Bob Mueller and his team would probably want to know why, too.
If that's the case, then how could he also be the attorney representing Trump in this investigation?
He's going to try to do that. The real problem that we have right now is, are there conflicts? Of course there are. We do know that he has a motive, in this case, to represent the president. Does that mean that it's going to be effective? You've got to consider what it is that he's being brought on to do. As we've been discussing, the real strength that Giuliani has is he has the ability to rev up the base. Is this about changing any minds here? If you look at the polling is very clear that most people's minds are not being swayed at this point. That's interesting to me because we've seen that Mueller continues to indict, and it doesn't change anybody's mind on the right or those who are supporting the president. So what he's trying to do is to drive more than just that base. The real question regarding Giuliani is whether or not he can grab more numbers than those that already exist for the president. Because if he doesn't drive the needle further, then he's not going to do anything. And what he might actually do, because he is so volatile, he's such a bomb thrower, that what he could actually do is drive those people in the center, the moderate, into the camps supporting Mueller, supporting the investigation, and questioning the president. So this could come back and bite the president.
That is Jack Rice. He is a former CIA officer, a trial advocacy educator, and trial lawyer. He was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. After 16 years of steady decline, malaria cases are on the rise again globally, and experts warn that unless efforts to tackle the disease are stepped up, the gains could be lost. Henry Bridgewell reporting now from a summit held in London where delegates urged a boost in funding for global antimalarial programs.
Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates has invested billions of dollars into tackling malaria. It has paid off. Deaths from the disease fell by more than 60% between 2000 and 2015, meaning 7 million lives were saved. In 2016, however, that trend was reversed. There were more than 216 million reported cases in 91 countries, an increase of 5 million from the previous year.
The co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Mr. Bill Gates.
On the sidelines of this week's London Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, Gates told delegates, including several African leaders, the fight against malaria must be stepped up.
If we don't keep innovating, we will go backwards. If we don't maintain the commitments that we're making here today, malaria would go back up and kill over a million children a year.
Malaria is estimated to cost the African economy more than $12 billion per year and consumes up to 40% of national healthcare budgets on the continent. Children and pregnant women are most severely affected. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The term fake news is heard a lot these days, especially from President Trump, other politicians, as well as journalists, all posted on social media platforms like Twitter. Some high school students in the United States and around the world are getting a better understanding of fake and real news by learning literacy media skills in the classroom. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to a high school in Arlington, Virginia.
18 times.
Here at Wakefield High School in Arlington, Virginia, these seniors are learning to identify false or misleading information.
What's the big deal about people being misinformed?
Social studies teacher Patricia Hunt is using a digital course called Checkology to give students real-world examples of news and information that is either factual, misleading, or just plain false. Take February's high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, where 14 students and three teachers were killed. She asks the students to think about whether the rumors that swirled after the shooting were actually real.
Students are bombarded with information, and they are also bombarded with so-called news, fake news, viral rumors, and misinformation. My hope in my lessons is that they will be able to identify quality journalism when they see it, and they'll be able to identify unfair, unbalanced, fake propaganda and the like when they see it too.
Studies have shown that teens get most of their information from social media, and they are more likely to believe the information they get from their friends. Ellen Miller is the founder of the nonprofit News Literacy Project, which includes Checkology.
I've really been struck by how students tend to see all information as created equal. If they're younger, they may think that if somebody put it on the internet, they verified it, and it's all true. And they're inclined to believe it and to share it. By the time they're in high school, they're often more cynical. And they may feel that it's all equally driven by bias, by agenda. What's missing is that critical thinking skill to know what to do with all of that information.
This student plans to look at social media with a more critical eye.
Now I know how to decipher what's real and what's fake and what to look for.
What we want the students to take away is the ability to assess the credibility of all news and information they encounter.
And it seems to be working.
I learned about fact-checking and ways to find false news, you know, like by headlines and seeing if there's publishers.
I think I'll be able to kind of go through news a lot better. I'll be able to kind of rest easier knowing that I'm not going to be tricked as easily.
Thousands of educators are using the digital Checkology courses in the U.S. and in 90 other countries, helping students recognize for themselves
fake media, fake news,
if what they are hearing or seeing is true or not. Deborah Block, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
Where did you get that information?
And we're joined now by VOA's Doug Bernard for what's trending on social media. Doug, I understand it's largely about Barbara Bush today.
Well, even though it's been a few days now, about a day and a half, since former First Lady Barbara Bush passed on at the age of 92 at her home in Houston, lots of people are still talking about it on Twitter. This is no surprise. She was, for decades, really a mainstay figure in American politics, not just the wife of one president, but the mother of another president, and, of course, the whole Bush family, is mother of a prominent governor who went on to make a run for the presidency himself. So lots of people talking about her. I'm seeing lots of images on Facebook and some on Twitter of women, not necessarily Republicans either, just women who are posting pictures of themselves wearing those pearls that she always wore. Barbara Bush, of course, very, very famous for the artificial pearls that she always wore. Sorry to say that, yes, they were artificial. But so lots of people just, you know, sort of offering their good thoughts. This is a Marshall Ramsey, excuse me. Barbara Bush was tough, witty, blunt, protective, and beloved by many. But she also suffered one of the most painful losses a parent can face. I pray she and her daughter, Robin, are together today. Barbara Bush lost her daughter, Robin. Robin, at the age of 3, she died of leukemia. And Ms. Barbara Bush and the whole Bush family have said that that was an event that that put a permanent mark on the family in terms of what people wanted to do with their lives. The History Channel is tweeting out a variety of quotes from Barbara Bush. Here's one, quote, "I married the first man I ever kissed, and when I tell this to my children, they just about throw up." There's a lot of bad information also out there floating around in social media. Here's one example. How many of my Twitter fam knows that Barbara Bush was the daughter of of Aleister Crowley. Oh, yes, it's a fact. No, it is not. She was not a daughter of Aleister Crowley. She was, in fact, the daughter of the man who ran McCall's magazine and Red Book. So just for what that's worth. There's a bit of a Twitter controversy going on. A professor named Randa Jarrar at Fresno State University has been tweeting out. She began with this tweet and has gone since from there. Quote, Barbara Bush was a generous and smart and amazing racist who, along with her husband, raised a war criminal. And, of course, a lot of people, many, many people, taking exceptions with that. The professor is remaining defiant. Perhaps just this one last from a legal follower. He calls himself Barrister Banter, and he has this quote from Barbara Bush, maybe the best way to end this. Quote, at the end of your life, you will never regret not having passed one more test, not winning one more verdict, or not closing one more deal. You will regret time not spent with a husband, a friend, a child, or a parent. The words of Barbara Bush. So lots of people taking time to remember the passing of an American icon.
And many thanks to you, Doug. That's VOA's Doug Bernard, and this is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is on a path to begin offering tourist visas for the first time. Historical parts of the country are under major renovations to places like Diriyah, not far from the capital of Riyadh. Area is now a certified World Heritage Site by UNESCO, and billions of dollars will go to develop untouched land along the Red Sea near Jordan and Egypt. Salah Atalab with the Tourism and Investment Initiative says the country is trying to speed up the visa application process.
As well as making sure all the procedures to come to Saudi and access the country is in a very smooth way for the international tourists to use.
Visitors like Chris Brooks from Britain says there's an amazing history in the area worth seeing, but it takes a long time to get a visa.
It needs to be more welcoming, more accessible. It takes a lot of time to get a visa to come here.
The kingdom plans to issue some 200,000 visas in the first year. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, the music world is filled with influential artists, we all know that, so choosing just five might be quite a challenge. That's how many have made it to the list of this year's Time 100 Most Influential People of 2018. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald reviews Time's top five music influencers with VOA's Jim Stevenson.
It's out. It's that time of year. Time for the Time 100, the 100 most influential people of the year. And undoubtedly, musicians are on that list.
Yes, we have five pop musicians who made the cut on the Time 100 for 2018. Rihanna, Jennifer Lopez, Cardi B, Shawn Mendes, and Kesha. Now, each artist came with a tribute written by another famous person. Adele paid tribute to Rihanna, and she writes, I actually can't remember the first time I met Rihanna. I was probably numb from the shock of it. She goes on to say, Rihanna makes her own rules and bends ours. And of course, that is true. Rihanna is known for going her own way.
And that makes her very influential.
In very influential terms. Cyndi Lauper paid tribute to Kesha, and of course, Kesha became a pivotal figure in the Me Too movement in her fight against record producer Dr. Luke, who she says physically and mentally harassed her. Actress Kerry Washington inducts Jennifer Lopez in the icon category, of course, and turns out both Jennifer and Kerry grew up in New York City's Bronx neighborhood. Kerry says she remembers watching Jennifer Lopez become the cultural force that she is today. Tyra G.P. Henson, the actress, praised Cardi B's grit and her honesty. Cardi makes no bones about where she came from, who she is, and she's very down-to-earth about it. And Tyra G says, Cardi B is here to stay, baby. Mm-hmm. And then finally, this choice interested me very much. Shawn Mendes made the cut, and he is the youngest member of the group. He's only 19 years old. John Mayer inducted Shawn, and he says, the fine art of Shawn Mendes is that you're watching him discover music in real time. Sean is also a Time magazine favorite because in 2016, he earned a slot on their list of the 30 most influential people under age 30. So the latest Time 100 is out, and pop music made its mark.
In the old days, we would say, pick it up at your local newsstand. Now it's online.
And if you want to see the entire selection of Time 100 honorees, you can go to our Facebook page, VOA One The Hits.
It's an impressive list, 100 influential people in the world. We count down the top 20 most influential songs of the week each and every week. Ray McDonald is your host. You'll find him on VOA One.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Ray.
All right. Something big is happening. Take this spark and start a fire. Raise us up, we're feeling high. They can't tell us anything. Something big is happening. I can think I feel it opening out of my control. Pushing, pulling, and it's grabbing me. Feel it in my bones.
And many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for this program, International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. We hope that you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Along with allies Britain and France, the United States has sent a clear message to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his patrons, Russia and Iran. The use of chemical weapons will not be tolerated. On April 13th, the three of five permanent members of the UN Security Council launched a proportional, precise, and coordinated strike against Assad regime targets associated with the use of chemical weapons in Syria. They included a scientific research facility near Damascus, which developed, produced, and tested chemical and biological warfare technology, a chemical weapons storage facility west of Homs, and a chemical weapons equipment storage facility near Homs that was also an important command post. The aim of the strike was to limit Assad's ability to use chemical weapons against his own people, as he has repeatedly done, and to deter the proliferation of chemical weapons, which, by international law, have been banned for almost a century. Great care was taken by the United States and its allies to avoid civilian and foreign casualties. It was the second time the United States responded to Assad's use of chemical weapons. The first was in April 2017, after Assad conducted a chemical weapons attack on the village of Khan Sheikhoun. The coordinated strike by the U.S. and its allies on April 13th was about twice as large. In an address to the American people, President Donald Trump spoke about the scores of Syrians killed in yet another chemical weapons attack by the regime on April 7th in the town of Douma.
The evil and the despicable attack left mothers and fathers, infants and children, thrashing in pain and gasping for air. These are not the actions of a man. They are crimes of a monster instead.
President Trump included a message for the two governments most responsible for supporting, equipping, and financing the criminal Assad regime.
To Iran and to Russia, I ask, what kind of a nation wants to be associated with the mass murder of innocent men, women, and children?
President Trump emphasized that establishing a deterrent against the production, spread, and use of chemical weapons is a vital security interest of the United States. Moreover, he noted, the action taken by Britain, France, and the U.S. April 13th is a noble one. The three countries marshaled their righteous power against barbarism and brutality.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.